This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Today, we examine the ongoing issues surrounding this week's anniversary of the assassination of a federal judge who sought administrative reform and the incapacitation of a U.S. representative who challenged Pentagon energy policy and restrictive immigration laws. It was on the 8th of January, 2011, that a heavily armed gunman killed six and wounded two dozen more at a Tucson public forum convened by Arizona Representative Gabrielle Giffords. She suffered brain injury from a gunshot wound in the assassination attempt. Among the half-dozen dead was federal judge John Roll, who was fatally wounded by a shot in his back as he shielded a member of Giffords' staff. Judge Roll had joined Giffords to discuss the national caseload crisis caused by longstanding congressional and executive branch failures to efficiently nominate, approve, and then appoint a backlog of federal judgeships. A year after the slaughter, the nation still faces an unprecedented federal judicial vacancy crisis, with 19 pending judicial nominees being denied approval votes, due mostly to unstated Republican objections. The unappointed judges are supported by both home state senators in each case and have already been approved by the Judiciary Committee. But amid partisan posturing, the Senate recessed without addressing the logjam, which denies thousands of federal defendants their constitutional right to a speedy trial. As we shall hear, Giffords and Roll had also sought a rational approach to immigration issues in the face of right-wing xenophobia in the southwestern border state, culminating in a major case of worker exploitation that was presided over by Roll. Giffords, meanwhile, had introduced legislation to ease immigrant work visas, as well as challenging the greenhouse consequences of the Pentagon's aversion to solar energy. We now review those issues in this anniversary edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow's contemporaneous coverage of the murder spree and its continuing consequences.
I'm Sheriff Clarence Dupnik, D-U-P-N-I-K, Pima County Sheriff. I've been a police officer in this community for over 50 years. 30 of which has been a sheriff. And in my 50-some years, I have never been so shocked in my life as the events that happened today. It's not only a very sad day for Tucson and for the family, for the friends of all the victims of this horrendous, horrendous, senseless, unbelievable crime. But it's a sad day for America. First, if we may, I'm going to provide you with some of the details as to what happened, kind of a thumbnail sketch. And then we have the person in charge of the FBI for the state of Arizona. We have Nate Gray. This is a day of personal sadness for very many of us in this room. People like Dr. Carmona, who is the 17th Surgeon General of the United States and has been a Pima County Sheriff's Deputy for some 25 years. He's going to follow Nate Gray and answer any questions that you may have reference medical issues. But this morning around 10 a.m., Congresswoman Giffords was having a town hall type of meeting outside in a kind of a strip mall situation outside Safeway grocery store. She does this frequently. There was no indication of any problems, but at about 10 minutes after 10, a gunman approached and started shooting. Congresswoman Giffords was shot once in the head. She's still alive, and the surgeon in charge is cautiously optimistic that she may survive. Five people were killed, two of whom are personal friends of mine, including Councilwoman Giffords, one being a federal judge, John Roll, who this morning got up like he does on every Saturday morning, went to Mass, because he knows Gabrielle very well, decided to come around the corner and say hi. Unfortunately, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I've never met a more sincere, fair-minded, brilliant federal judge, or any judge for that matter, in my whole life. John Roll has been on the federal bench for a number of years. Before that, he was a prosecutor for the Pima County Attorney's Office. And we also have the county attorney in the audience, Barbara Wall. One of the finest human beings I've ever met in my life. He was a frequent attendant at daily Mass downtown at the cathedral. And this morning he went to Mass and was going to go home and do the floors, which he always does on Saturday. Congresswoman Giffords was an incredibly gifted legislator. She still is. She's one of the nicest human beings that has ever been planted on this earth. She's not only brilliant, she's works from dawn till dawn, basically. And she cares what really happens in this country. She's not about Democrats or Republicans. She's not about politics. All she cares about is the United States of America. And today, I want to tell you, I hope that all Americans are saddened and as shocked as we are. And I hope that some of them, or most of them, are as angry as I am and as a lot of us are. And I think it's time as a country that we need to do a little soul searching, because I think it's the vitriolic rhetoric that we hear day in and day out from people in the radio business and some people in the TV business, and what we see on TV and how our youngsters are being raised, that this has not become the nice United States of America that most of us grew up in. And I think it's time that we do the soul searching.
Sheriff Clarence Dupnik of Tucson, Arizona, discussing not only the details but possible motives in the terrorist incident that resulted in the death of a half dozen people, including a federal judge, and severe brain injuries to Representative Gabrielle Giffords of Arizona. This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and to help analyze that, we're now joined by the senior fellow of the Campaign for America's Future, Sarah Robinson, who joins us live from Seattle, Washington. Sarah, we've just been listening to the sheriff intimating that there's something behind the story beyond the incident, that there may be a climate of advocacy of violence and recklessness. What is your reaction to that?
I don't think probably anybody in your audience there would have much disagreement with the idea that the 20-year campaign of right-wing violent rhetoric on the part of radio and TV talkers, and which has moved itself from the fringes of the right into the point where we have elected GOP officials now spouting this kind of stuff, you know, on national TV. I don't think anybody could deny that this has created a climate in which people who are already a little unstable find that their instabilities are given motivation and direction and lead them in very dangerous directions.
Members of the conservative talk establishment and political liaisons say that they're just pushing back, that there is wild and crazy extreme rhetoric coming from Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals, all across the spectrum. I wonder if you agree that there is a symmetry there.
There is no symmetry there. That's a total false equivalency. There is no doubt that if you go into the comments threads on Daily Kos or Democratic Underground or Alternet, you know, any of the places where progressives hang out, that if you dig around in the comments threads, you know, long enough, you will find some things that are pretty incendiary. No question. The difference between the left and the right is that the left has had, since the 70s, you know, the right wing in the 70s used, you know, left-wing violence through the 60s and 70s to discredit our movement, to make us look like we were the political crazies, and to delegitimize us in the eyes of Americans. There's a sort of dirty hippies meme that we were all crazy and anarchic and violent. And it worked. And what happened was we on the left got very responsible about who we gave microphones to, who we put on TV, who we put on the radio, who we elected to office. We have our crazies. We do not put them in the public square. And that is the key difference. In the right wing, it is okay for anybody, you know, up to including people in Congress, to say absolutely wild, incendiary things that no responsible liberal would ever say in public.
Sarah Robinson of the Campaign for America's Future, one of the things that has been more recent, I suppose, with the proliferation of easy Internet access and the exuberance, the take-no-prisoners attitude of campaign politics in America today, is that not only publicity-seeking blowhards of the conservative talk show circuit, and some on the liberal talk show circuit, that they have been transcended or even superseded by actual candidates and office holders. Is that a new thing?
That's a natural evolution, you know, that the right wing, starting with Rush in the 90s and this wave of hate talkers that started on radio in the 90s and then moved on to TV and, you know, ultimately now Glenn Beck on Fox. There's a natural evolution that they've created this whole climate where now almost the entire conservative voting base is being motivated by this kind of angry speech. And there's an addictive quality to it. You know, it gives adrenaline hits that people come back for over and over again. And it bonds them to the conservative movement as listeners of these shows, so it's good for ratings, but also as voters. And basically all the conservative leaders have to do is press these anger buttons, and people are motivated, and they turn out, and they show up, and they listen. So there's been a strong motivation for the conservatives to enlarge this campaign because it really works for them. It turns out their base. And it has resulted in the people who were best at that getting elected to office.
Sarah, there has been much discussion about a campaign poster of former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin that spoke of targeting certain districts that included the one in which Ms. Giffords was reelected to Congress. But that's not the only one. There was in March or in spring of the year 2010, a more explicit statement on the part of Sarah Palin. And I'd like you to listen to this and the defense of it by Arizona Senator John McCain.
Don't retreat, reload, and that is not a call for violence.
I have seen the rhetoric of targeted districts as long as I've been in politics. Please, any threat of violence is terrible, but to say that there's a targeted district or that we reload or go back into the fight again, please.
Those are her words.
Those are fine. They're used all the time. Those words have been used throughout my political career.
But should
there
they
are
be targeted perhaps used
districts.
Last? Sorry for interrupting,
there are
Senator.
Targeted districts and there are areas that we call battleground states, and so please, that rhetoric and kind of language is just part of the political lexicon. It is no place for threats of violence or anything else, but to say that someone is in a battleground state is not originated today.
Senator, with all due respect, and I heard
with
what you had
respect,
to say, let me just,
that's,
me,
that's,
let me just inject
respect,
this one question,
it.
Sir.
Sure.
And the question is, given, even if what you're saying is accepted by everyone, that this is the language of campaigning, this is the language of politics, given, however, the sensitivity regarding this particular bill, should this still be the language of this day, given how much we are hearing about hundreds of calls regarding threats, about vandalism, about the gas line of a congressman's brother's home being cut? Sir, these are very dangerous times. Is this the language that we should be hearing today?
The language that we should be using today is the language that we are using. We condemn violence.
Comments from Sarah Palin this spring and a reaction to that from the senator from Arizona, scene of the Tucson crime, saying that to reload is an appropriate rhetorical statement on the part of Palin and perhaps others. Sarah Robinson, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, what do you make of that, and where do politicians go from here?
Mm. I agree with John McCain to a certain degree. All right, targeting and battleground, indeed, are old political words. I grew up in a political family. We've always used that kind of language. But you can target a district with money, with advertising, with organizers. You know, there's all kinds of ways to target something. But when Sarah Palin goes so far as to say, reload, what she is saying is now she's bringing guns into that image. All right, it's not necessarily we're targeting with guns until you start using language like, you know, reload. And that's been a part of Sarah Palin's charm. You know, she's this Mama Grizzly image. She, you know, carries guns. She shoots wolves from helicopters. That's a big piece of her appeal to the kind of NRA Republican base, that rural, you know, evangelical Republican sort of base. And guns are packed into her image, this gun-toting mama thing. And so when she says things like reload, she's, you know, she's keying on all this stuff that's latent in a Republican kind of mythology. And she's absolutely evoking the idea that we should be shooting people. As likewise, Sharon Angle, when she talked about Second Amendment remedies. Mm. And when you know, one of my favorite quotes from Jefferson, the business about the tree of liberty needing to be watered, you know, every 20 years by the blood of patriots and tyrants. I grew up loving that quote because I think it does speak to the kind of vigilance we need to have as Americans. I'm very distressed that it's been appropriated by the Tea Party. But it's all of this rhetoric that justifies the taking up of arms and shooting public officials, and now it's happened. And now they need to reckon with where that language has brought us.
Sarah, I know that you are involved in what is called the social fusion movement, and I'm wondering how you and others approach the nexus that is American lethal politics today, the nexus of anger, ignorance, manipulative misdirection, racism, sexism, xenophobia, and chauvinism. How do we get out of this brew into something more life-sustaining?
I'm a social futurist, not necessarily a fusionist, but definitely a futurist. And my interest is in how people meet change. And I think most Americans, left and right, understand themselves at this moment to be in the moment of a tremendous kind of existential crisis, almost certainly the biggest one we've been in since the era of FDR, you know, in 80 years, and which was at that time the biggest one since the Civil War, which was the biggest one since the Revolution. So every 80 years or so, we go through this remaking where we go back to first principles and we remake America, the economy, but also our society. We redraw our priorities. And I think Americans left and right are all feeling very much like our government doesn't speak for us, that it's not addressing the problems that we need to have solved. But we're dealing with it in very different ways. And the right is dealing with it by trying to hold on to the old American dream, the old regime, the, you know, kind of the old oil-based, white privilege-based, racist order, the post-war order as we've known it for the last 80 years. They can't let go of it. They're not going to let go of it without a fight. And, of course, there are a lot of forces, you know, status quo, the oil companies and a lot of the big corporations that are really content to have those foot soldiers hold on to that status quo as long as they can. And on the other side, you have the progressives, whose role in American history at these moments has always been, going back over 200 years, to re-envision, to do the re-envisioning and to lead America to the next future. And progressives are trying very hard to do that now. And we're talking about the demands of climate change and of the need to get off of oil and the obligations that we have to take care of each other. So there's been this great unraveling of society by the conservatives over the last 30 years where they've told people that we do not have to look after each other. We do not have to take care of each other. You're on your own, and that's okay. All of that has been... You know, and I think we've hit the end of that, and people have seen that that's a bankrupt way of living now. And I think the racism and the sexism and a lot of the things you talked about are coming to an end because we are realizing that we have to pull back together as a country if we're going to make it through this crisis. And you see that a lot in people who are under 30, under 40, who are really understanding that we are all in this together. And that's a very encouraging thing because those kids are going to be running the show in another 10 years.
Is the American crisis of conscience and propensity for violence separable from the international regime? You allude to the oil companies and such. And certainly there's very little difference between liberal governments and conservative governments, Democrats and Republicans, in the waging of war on behalf of resources and the use of xenophobia, racism in terms of mobilizing an American public against whoever the target of the day may be. How do you figure the international global resource allocation issues into the madness of American politics today?
America is an empire. And we're a very ambivalent one. We're not like the English, who loved being imperialists. They, you know, that they threw themselves wholeheartedly into it. You know, they trained their children to it. They structured their government and economy around it, and were completely unapologetic. And Americans, at heart, were Democrats, and we know in our bones that empire is incompatible with democracy. And we are being faced with the choice. One of the things that's happening in this crisis is we're being faced with the choice of whether we're going to be an empire or a democracy. And, of course, the economic powers that be that run the current status quo are all profiting massively off of the empire, the continuation of empire. And I think one of the conversations we're going to be having over the next 10 to 15 years is about that. I think the millennial generation is showing signs of being considerably more, well, they want to use the word isolationist, but I don't think that's the right word. We are concerned with getting our house in order at home. And far less concerned with doing damage. You know, they see the damage that's done abroad. So I think that the era of American empire is due for a strong renegotiation. And if it continues at all for another 10 or 15 years, it will emerge in a very different shape.
We're so grateful for your deep analysis today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. Sarah Robinson, Senior Fellow with the Campaign for America's Future, we offer you this concluding word for any thoughts that might occur to you, and how people might more closely follow your own work.
I have been blogging at ourfuture.org. I'm working on a project now for the larger progressive movement, and I'm some other things as well. But my past work is all there at ourfuture.org.
Well, we shall be following that, and I suspect we'll be speaking again in the future. I'm so honored, and thank you for joining us today. Sarah Robinson on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thank you very much.
My name is Robert Knight. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio, originating at New York station WBAI. And coming up, we will be speaking with the National Senior Council of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, on the implications of the events in Tucson in regard to immigrant labor, undocumented worker rights in these United States. That coming up after we take a grim and sober look at the actual consequences of the rhetoric and instigation that we were discussing just moments ago with Sarah Robinson. These are the actual ear witness, eyewitness accounts of the events, the tragic events of this weekend in Tucson.
911, where's your emergency?
This is Gifford.
Hello? Hello?
Oh, 911, there was a shooting at Gateway.
Okay, what do you mean?
Ina and Oracle, where Gabrielle Giffords was. And I do believe Gabrielle Giffords was hit.
At Safeway, sir?
Yes, Safeway.
Was somebody shot then, sir?
Yes, the guy, it looked like the guy had a semi-automatic pistol, and he went in, he just started firing, and then he ran.
We got, okay.
He ran north past the Walgreens that's right next to the Safeway.
Sir, what was he wearing?
He was wearing a hoodie.
What color was the hoodie?
It was black.
Okay. What color were his pants?
He looked like he was wearing blue jeans, and he was wearing a black sweater.
Okay. Is anybody injured? Did you say Gabrielle Giffords was hit?
She's hit.
Okay.
I believe she's breathing.
She is breathing.
She still has a pulse, and we got two people, and we got one dead.
Okay.
And they're injured.
Okay, and there's other people that are injured?
There's multiple people shot.
Okay. Oh, my God.
He appeared to probably be in his probably 20s to late, probably 30s.
So what color hair did he have?
I could not see because
He had the hood over his head?
Yeah, it was more of like a beanie, actually.
Okay.
So I could not see his hair color. He, like I said, he shot.
Okay.
Ran. You okay, sir? We got help coming.
911, where is your emergency?
The emergency is at 4. And Ina, it's a shooting. I've been called by a member of Congress and different staff to say there's a bunch of people shot.
Yes, sir. We have reports of that, and we have deputies on the scene. Hello, sir?
Yes.
This is 911. Do you have an emergency?
Yes, I was just cut off from 911. There's a shooting at Oracle and Ina involving a number of people. I'm an assistant chief of the police department, and
okay.
I keep getting dropped call. I need to get it through to make sure that you've got people en route.
Yes, we do. We have deputies on scene.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
911, where is your emergency?
My husband just called me and told me he was shot. He went to the Gabrielle Giffords, whatever they were doing today, and I don't know where he is.
Okay. Hold on. We do have reports of that. We have deputies on the scene. I just want to get some information from
okay.
you. Your husband was shot.
That's what he said. He just called
okay.
me, and then the phone went dead.
There was a Gabrielle Giffords convention. Is that what it was?
He said it was something. He left the house. He said, I'm going over where Gabrielle Giffords is talking.
Okay. 911, where's your emergency?
I'm not an Oracle. There's been a shooting at Safeway. I have a person shot here on the floor in the wall, please.
Okay, I'm going to connect you with medical. Hold on just a moment.
Okay.
Emergency dispatcher, what is the address?
Our address is 7114 North Oracle Road. We need more than one ambulance. There's more than one person down.
Okay, and what happened there?
A guy came to the Safeway and started shooting. I saw him. He was in a beanie and a hooded sweatshirt and jeans.
We've got that. This is the sheriff's office. We've probably got the suspect detained, but of course you're going to have to hold off.
Okay. Ma'am, we do have the help on the way. How many people are in there?
We have about a total of 10 people, maybe more. Oh, my God.
All right. And we do have the help on the way, okay, ma'am? We're going to open as soon as the sheriff's department says that we can, okay?
Okay.
The sounds of the event of this Saturday, the terrorist attack on those gathered at a community hearing of Representative Giffords, and that resulted in a number of deaths, a half dozen included, including Phyllis Schneck, Dorothy Morris, Christina Taylor Green, Gabe Zimmerman, Berwyn Stoddard, and U.S. District Judge John M. Roll, who himself had been under death threats for his presiding over a trial for the rights of immigrant workers in the United States. That is why we are so honored to have with us live from San Antonio, Texas, Nina Perales. She is the National Senior Counsel of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. And Nina, you took up litigation on behalf of guest workers or undocumented workers, immigrants from Mexico into the state of Arizona. And the late Judge John Roll presided over that case that had a positive outcome for the plaintiffs that you represented. Can you tell us the background of that case.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. The background of the case was that MALDEF represented a group of folks who were crossing the border without permission, and they were assaulted by a vigilante rancher named Roger Barnett, who had assaulted other people in the past. This was actually the second case that we were involved in related to Mr. Barnett, and the other case had been one where he had attacked a group of Latino U.S. citizens along the border. In this case, there was a group of people who were crossing, and he came upon them, he assaulted them, he threatened their lives, he kicked one of the women. And the case that was in front of Judge Roll was a tort suit against the vigilante rancher. It was a jury case.
The outcome of that actually resulted in, I believe it was a civil case that resulted in some recompense to the plaintiffs, right?
Yes. The jury, after they heard the whole case and deliberated, awarded $73,000 in damages against the rancher, Mr. Barnett.
You have, I presume, been following the events of this past weekend, the tragic events. And the reason we're so pleased to have you with us today is because there has been not, in our opinion, a sufficient addressing of the immigration issue. Certainly, it is my recollection that Judge Roll was threatened many times for his life in allowing that case to proceed. Are you aware of that?
Yes. The attorneys who tried the case, and I was supervising that team, but I wasn't there on every day, knew that the judge had received threats. They knew that his home address had been posted on the Internet. We were certainly aware of the increased security from the court security officers in the courtroom. And one evening, my team saw a judge leaving the courthouse, driving away, driving home, as our team was as well. And it was obvious that he was accompanied by law enforcement at that time.
Did his behavior and conduct of the court appear, in your or your colleague's estimation, to be fair and proper?
Yes, absolutely. He ran a very normal courtroom. I mean, although I understand he was disturbed by the threats against him, as we were disturbed by the threats that were also being aimed at us during that time, he continued to run a very normal courtroom. He did not acknowledge that that was going on, and he dispensed justice, you know, as a judge would, who's very committed to the rule of law.
You are the National Senior Counsel for MALDEF, one of the leading rights-defending organizations for workers who come across the border. And I'm wondering how the policies and positions of the tragically attacked member of Congress, Gabrielle Giffords, I'm wondering how the politics of immigration rights, workers' rights, and so on figures into your understanding of this weekend's events.
Well, I think it's hard to say exactly how they did play in. Clearly, the person who did this was a deeply, deeply disturbed person and very psychologically unstable. I think it is certainly possible that the overheated rhetoric around immigration can affect people who are deeply psychologically disturbed and cause them to do things that they shouldn't do. But it's impossible to say, I think, until we know more exactly how the whole immigration debate and politics around immigration affected the events of Saturday. I think it's still wise for people to examine their rhetoric and how they talk about this issue to make sure that they are not unduly inflaming the public.
You and your colleagues at MALDEF certainly have a tremendous amount of work cut out for you. And one of the things that the judge was said to have been discussing with the member of Congress was the overloading of federal judges, the caseload being so high, the throughput so low, and the need for more federal judge appointments. Can you help us understand how that matters to the delivery of justice?
Oh, it matters tremendously. The federal judiciary is very overworked, particularly along the border where there's a really heavy criminal docket in addition to the civil docket, and the judges are required to hear criminal cases on a set schedule, which really, I think, squeezes the ability for them to hear civil cases, such as the one that we were presenting to Judge Roll. And in this way, I think the shortage of judges and the slow pace of confirming new judges, because we have many vacancies right now that have to be filled, is negatively impacting the judges' ability to hear cases.
It's our understanding that the Obama administration is appointing judges at perhaps one-half or one-third the rate over an equal period of time than President Bush did before him. Why is that, and how could this be done better?
I don't know why it's happening, but it is certainly important for the administration to prioritize the filling of judicial vacancies. The administration of justice depends on it, and it needs to be an important enough priority that these vacancies are actually getting filled.
Nina, what is the main body? You're speaking with us from San Antonio, Texas, but you are a national organization, and I think many of our listeners, even here in the Northeast, would like to know what the main body of your work is in regard to Mexican-American and, by implication, other immigrant labor rights and human rights in this country.
Well, MALDEF is focused on certain program areas, which doesn't mean that this is the full universe of things we could work on. We could work on a lot of things, but in order to maximize our resources, we are focused on education, employment, voting rights, and immigration civil rights. And by that we mean challenging policies that negatively affect large groups of immigrants, as opposed to doing regular, you know, straight-up immigration service work. And I have to tell you that my specialty is actually voting rights. But every lawyer at MALDEF has had to turn attention to working on cases related to immigration civil rights since we've had this enormous anti-immigrant backlash. It's affected all of us.
Well, we certainly are grateful for the work for rights that you're doing. How can people learn more about your own work, that of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and perhaps be supportive of it?
Well, we would appreciate it a great deal, and we have a wonderful website at maldef.org.
Well, Nina Perales, once again, a great honor to have you with us. We think that the story has not yet been sufficiently covered in the tragic reaction to those terrible events over the weekend, and I think you've helped advance the story, and I thank you for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Robert Knight. You're tuned to perhaps WBAI in New York, or perhaps WBAI.org, streaming live on the web. We still have more. One of the things that Representative Giffords has also been famous for is not only the issue of immigration in Arizona, but the issue of energy, in particular solar energy. And nowhere more unexpectedly and significantly was that issue brought up in regard to the United States wars around the world than in a recent hearing of the Energy and Security Committee just a few months ago. During the time of the BP oil spill, we here on these airwaves devoted much time to the fact that BP, the Gulf oil spiller, is the single largest provider of oil, petroleum, gasoline, and fuel to the United States wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we were therefore aware that the biggest polluter on the planet is the Pentagon, the biggest consumer of gasoline is the Air Force. And these issues came up in a prescient encounter between Representative Giffords and General Petraeus, commander of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's worth hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General Petraeus, welcome back to committee, and Madam Secretary, thank you as well. Hailing from southern Arizona, I'm glad you're staying hydrated. Very important, considering that we know out in the desert. And on behalf of the men and women of Fort Huachuca and Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, we just want to thank both of you for your service. And unfortunately, we lost two of our airmen actually associated with Davis-Monthan, senior airman Benjamin White, who was 24, and also Tech Sergeant Michael Paul Flores, 31. We're both based at Davis-Monthan, and we're part of the rescue command. Very sad. Very much brings home, you know, what we're asking of our men and women. There's been a lot of attention back here in the United States on what's happening with the BP oil spill. And as we all know, the largest user of energy on the planet is actually the United States Air Force, and the DOD is the largest user of energy in the United States. And I really want to commend the work done on behalf of DOD and also what's happening in the field with our energy. But it's an area that I just really want to focus on, and I know a lot of questions have been asked, but during the last 3 years, supply lines have increasingly threatened have been threatened either by enemy action or through international places. And in places like Kandahar, where we have a large presence, we've been plugged into a very unsustainable and really an incapable grid system. We know that a major part of the upcoming Kandahar offensive will include some serious repairs and upgrades to the energy system, which will include small-scale solar and hydropower systems and also some solar-powered streetlights. I'm just curious whether or not there's plans to utilize any of those same technologies at our bases around Afghanistan, and wouldn't that greatly reduce our need for fuel?
I pause because there are a couple of different components to what we're trying to do with respect to energy reduction, if you will, and that's really what it is about. And there's, again, a fairly comprehensive effort in that regard. We don't have hydropower, obviously, access to that in the basis, but there has been a significant effort which has reduced very substantially, actually, what we've needed for the cooling and heating of our workplaces and living places. And that is sometimes as simple as pumping extra insulation into the roof and walls of these fairly rudimentary temporary buildings that we have, sometimes even the tents. And it's interesting because we were exchanging emails today with an individual who's involved in that effort, and we believe there have been actually billions of dollars of savings in this effort if you look at what we did in Iraq first in that regard and have now been pursuing in Afghanistan. If I could, I might note that the supply lines actually have worked well. The lines of communication through Pakistan, yes, there were periodically attacks, and there was one a week ago, but that followed a period of months and months, if not a year or so, since the last significant attacks. And it's much less than 1% of all of the cargo that goes in through Pakistan that is affected by these various attacks. And we're up now to some 70% of all supplies, not necessarily all materiel, but all supplies coming through the north, through this carefully constructed northern distribution network that we've been able to establish over the course of the last year in close partnership with U.S. Transportation Command, the State Department, that enables us to bring items through Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and into Afghanistan, and then even through some of the other countries. There are other routes, including one that comes out of Iraq through Turkey and then turns east. And we do use solar power in some cases, again, where that is provides a benefit to us. We did that in Iraq as well, by the way, I might point out, quite considerable use of that. And again, that's the case in Afghanistan as well. If I could add one final item, we're about to send you the new commander of Fort Huachuca, Brigadier General Promotable Steve Fogarty, has been a stellar military intelligence chief at Central Command over the last 2 years, has time in Afghanistan, former special mission unit intel chief, and so forth.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. As of January 2012, the question remains open whether Gabrielle Giffords will seek re-election to the House this November. Still, Giffords demonstrated her determination and continuing recovery at an anniversary memorial at Arizona University, where she was joined by her astronaut husband and other victims of the January 8th massacre.
I want to welcome all of you to this very special event as we gather once again as a strong and compassionate community to remember the tragedy of January 8th and honor the 6 good people who died, those who were wounded and are recovering, and to acknowledge the unity, compassion, love, and support that defines who we are. I'd like to invite Congresswoman Giffords to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. Welcome home, Congresswoman.
So again, on behalf of your University of Arizona, its students, its faculty and staff, I want to wish Congressman Gabrielle Giffords continued progress in her recovery so she can return to home to the mountains and the desert which she loves so deeply.
On behalf of the University Medical Center and all the personnel, thank you for the recognition and thank you for the respect. Today, let's not forget those who died, but let's also not forget to get past our sorrow and move forward with our lives. Those of us in medicine get our fuel from seeing people get back in the saddle again.
And yet, even with those painful realities, there is this. The sun still rises over the Rincon Mountains each and every morning. Tucson remains a great city, a special place, an oasis in the desert where our bonds of community were strengthened under the stress and sadness of a horrible moment.
Marco's shadow falls on the door to the seven lost city of gold.
California, Ms. Pelosi is recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I too want to join our colleagues in recognizing the contribution of the pages to the conduct of the House of Representatives. I thank them, and they have, as Mr. Kildee said and others have mentioned, borne witness to many important historic occasions here. But I can't think of any that is more special and means so much to our country than to witness the return of our colleague, who is the personification of courage, of sincerity, of admiration throughout the country. Congresswoman Gabby Giffords brings us presence today to make sure that we honor the obligations of our great country is important and symbolic. Her presence here in the chamber, as well as her service throughout her entire service in Congress, brings honor to this chamber. We are all privileged to call her colleague, some of us very privileged to call her friend. Throughout America, there isn't a name that stirs more love, more admiration, more respect, more wishing for our daughters to be like her than the name of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Thank you, Gabby, for joining us today.
Today's program dedicated to the fatal victims Phyllis Schneck, Dorothy Morris, Christina Taylor Green, Gabe Zimmerman, Dorwan Stoddard, and of course U.S. District Judge John Roll, with best wishes for a speedy and full recovery to Representative Giffords. We also give thanks today for production to Caitlin Prest, Cookie Palmer, Kathy Davis, Tony Bates, Bertil Reimers, and our engineer, Michael G. Haskins. My name is Robert Knight for 5 o'clock Shadow, and we close today's program with this from yet another victim of a madman with a pistol.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. They give me all kinds of warnings, save me from ruin. And when I say that I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange. But surely you're not happy now, you no longer play the game. Ah, people say I'm lazy, my life away. Well, they give me all kinds of advice designed to enlighten me. Tell them that I'm doing fine watching the shadows on the wall. Oh, don't you miss the big time, boy, you're no longer on the ball. I'm just sitting here making the wheels go round and round and rock the watch them roll. No longer riding on the merry-go-round, I just have to let it go. People asking questions, lost in confusion. Well, I tell them there's no problem, only solution. Well, they shake their heads and they look at me as if I've lost my mind. I tell them there's no hurry, I'm just sitting here doing time. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding on the merry-go-round, I just have to let it go. I just had to let it go.
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. We welcome your tips and comments with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.